Today is October 29th, and of course this is our class in what the Milton program calls Shivim Panim, Breshit. And if you remember, we've had a few classes going through different highlights of Sefer Breshit. And at this point, we have reached the unit in our folder that's called the Curse of Canaan. The Curse of Canaan. This is about what happens after the flood, after the world is destroyed, after Noah and his wife and their children and their children's wives and all the animals leave the ark. And what happens immediately after that, of course, is a new covenant, the Brit, with the allowance of eating meat that we talked about last time, and the rainbow, God promising not to destroy the whole world. And then comes the part of chapter 9 we're going to learn today, chapter 9, verses 18 to 27, the Curse of Canaan. It's one unit in our folder. We're going to spend two classes on it. The first class, we will not open the folder, or only at the very end of the class. The second class on this unit will be completely devoted to the sources in the folder. First, we have to give the biblical background and think about it ourselves, and then we'll see the sources they bring for us in the folder. So we want to open up the Tanakhim, open up the Bible, to chapter 9, verse 18 until 27, and read the verses. Chapter 9, in my edition, was on page 14. Breshit, right? Breshit. This class is in Breshit. Here we go. Verse 18. The sons of Noah, who came out of the ark, were Shem. I'll say it again. It's chapter 9, verse 18 of the book of Genesis, which is in the edition most of us have. It's verse 18 of page 14. Okay? The sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japhet. Ham being the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole world branched out. Noah, the tiller of the soil, was the first to plant the vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk, and he uncovered himself within his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japhet took a cloth, placed it against both their backs, and walking backward, they covered their father's nakedness. Which would mean they walked backwards with this blanket on their shoulders, and then they just let it fall on their father without looking, and he became covered. Their faces were turned the other way so that they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and learned what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves. Shall he be to his brothers?" And he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. Let Canaan be a slave to them. May God enlarge Japhet, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be a slave to them." Noah lived after the flood 350 years, and all the days of Noah came to 950 years. Then he died.
One of the things that's always frustrated me is the sins of the father being visited on the child.
Yes.
Why is Ham not punished instead of his son, or his son specifically mentioned?
Good question. I agree, it's a good question. It's such a good question that it's going to be one of our major questions. Not, of course, with the promise we'll have any great answers, but it's an important question. There are other questions in addition to that question. One major point, issue, problem I want to point out, and this relates to what Leslie just brought up, it's actually prior to what Leslie just brought up, is that there are two places in the verses we just read that a seemingly superfluous detail is mentioned. The same detail is mentioned twice, seemingly superfluously. What is it? And it's related to what Leslie said.
Well,
It says something twice, seemingly out of context, in that verse, unnecessary, superfluous. I mean something even more simple, straightforward.
Ham's the only one who has a child.
Right. Right, let's look at the verses again. Verse 18. The sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Yafet. The verse should end there. Now Shem had lots of children. Ham had lots of children. And Yafet had lots of children. None of the children of Shem are mentioned. None of the children of Yafet are mentioned. And of the children of Ham, only one is mentioned. Why is he mentioned? Now, we know why he's mentioned. Because later on in the story, for some reason, what Ham does brings a curse upon his son. That particular son. So it's mentioned, already foreshadowed here. But we were really being hit over the head with a sledgehammer. I mean, you could have waited to tell us. And it says it again, not just there. It says it in verse 22. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness. Why is it important to tell us the father of Canaan? You told us already in the previous verse. You're going to tell us later also. It seems to be really hitting us over the head with a sledgehammer that even though Ham is the person who's involved here, for some reason, when the Torah writes Ham, it means Canaan. I don't know what's going on here. But we'll have to spend much time looking at this. That's one point. But there are two other points I also want to begin with. There are two inconsistencies in the verses we just read. Until now we did with something that seems superfluous. It's mentioned again and again and again. But now I want to point that I want us to find two problems, two tensions, two inconsistencies within the verses that we just read. What are they? Well, you know what? One inconsistency.
Years to grow the grapes.
Okay. So, but that's not inconsistency. It could be it took years. It did take years.
Like, he curses Canaan and bless the Lord.
Well, the God of Shem.
Right, so the children that did good deeds are blessed, Shem and Yafet, and the child that did a bad deed is cursed. He's cursed by cursing his son. That's, of course, one problem that Leslie pointed out we'll have to deal with. But there's another glaring inconsistency here, and it has to do with two verbs. Let me just make sure I'm going to say these verbs correctly in the English translation. Yeah. One verb is D-O-N-E, and the other verb is S-A-W. What inconsistency do you see concerning the relationship between these two verbs, S-A-W and D-O-N-E?
Well, it doesn't say that he did anything. It says he saw him, and then right. Noah says what he had done.
Right. Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Let's just go back over there and make sure everyone sees that. That back in verse 22, it says, Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness. Saw, S-A-W. When Noah wakes up from his wine in verse 24, it says he learned what his youngest son had done. And you ask yourself, wait a second, what's going on there? Did he see or did he do? Now you might answer, wait a second, you might say, that if we go back to verse 22, it doesn't just say saw, it also says told.
Yeah.
So you might say, that's the answer. That when it says in verse 24 that Noah learned what his youngest son had done to him, the done doesn't refer to the saw, it refers to the tell. And that's a doing, that's an act. But that can't be. That can't be. Because look carefully in verse 24. When Noah woke up from his wine and learned what his youngest son had done to him. Now, I think that can't be referring, cannot be referring to the fact that his youngest son told the brothers, because that wouldn't be Noah learning what his youngest son had done to him. That's something his youngest son did. He told, but that's not a to him. It seems that Noah woke up and remembered something and experienced that happened to him when he was drunk. But the son telling the other brothers, that wouldn't be something that Noah would have experienced as done to him. So therefore, we're back to what we just heard, that there's an inconsistency. Verse 22 says, saw. Verse 24 says, done. Yes?
They're all males. And so I understand that it was that Shishanda that he saw his father and brothers.
Okay, very good. That's a very good point.
Maybe they did something.
Right, in other words, this is complimentary. We see it says saw, and then it says done. And we say, wait a second, what's so bad about seeing that such a curse should come out of it? The answer might be that seeing is really a euphemism for doing. Might be. I said might, you know.
Could it be a matter of disrespect? Was there some disrespect to what, you know, the son told about his father?
You know, you're saying that perhaps seeing, there is some something very bad in seeing. Well, perhaps it depends what Noah was doing when he was naked.
Well, you said what is uncovering your father's nakedness
and something else. Did you hear that?
Happens.
that uncovering of nakedness in other places in the Torah, which we will see, is a euphemism for something else.
Yeah.
What he did while he was in a drunken stupor. You know, what we could all use our imaginations as to.
So let's be more specific. I want to point out a methodological rule here, which might help us to organize our thoughts. We have here a tension and consistency between saw and done. When we ask ourselves, how are we going to bridge this inconsistency, how are we going to solve it, we can go methodologically in one of two directions. Either we can interpret seeing in terms of doing, or doing in terms of seeing. And I'll explain what I mean. I said two possibilities. Either pull doing to seeing or pull seeing to doing. But which is our baseline and which has to be reinterpreted in light of the other? So let's now flesh that out based on the things that people said in the room. If we say that doing is our baseline, we want to pull, we want to interpret the seeing in light of the doing, that would mean that the seeing really means doing. Doing is what we accept, that's the truth. When it says seeing, it means really doing. And indeed, as it was just pointed out, that perhaps seeing perhaps really means something else. It means a certain doing act. Perhaps it's a euphemism. Seeing his father's nakedness is perhaps a euphemism, like uncovering father's nakedness, which in the book of Leviticus means sexual intercourse, which would mean that he homosexually raped his father. That's what it means. Perhaps he saw his father's nakedness. Again, that's interpreting seeing in light of doing. What about the other side? Let's now interpret doing in light of seeing. Perhaps he really only saw. But seeing is considered to be an act. Like Myra said, perhaps he saw something so embarrassing that it's an act to feast your eyes on your father in a moment of terrible, terrible weakness and uncovering is considered to be a doing. That could be also. So we have two different directions we can go. Is the seeing really mean seeing? And it's such a terrible seeing that's called doing. Or does seeing really mean doing? And there really was a doing here, and the seeing is just a euphemism for that doing. Those are two possibilities we could go.
You've also told us at other times, knowing means being very intimate.
Ah, okay, very good. So Bruce brought that up, so let's continue that point. Where in the verses is the word knowing used?
Actually, it's not towards the end of verse 24.
Which verse?
It's there in verse 24.
Verse 24. It's not before. But does the verse 24 use the word know?
Learn.
Learn.
Oh, yes, right.
But Bruce was right anyway, and Jenna's right anyway, because the translation is misleading. The Hebrew word in verse 24 is that Noah woke up from his wine and he knew what his youngest son had done to him. And here the translation, by trying to make it clearer, actually obscures the literary hint that this is all about knowing. It's all about knowing.
What's the word in the
Hebrew? V'yeda.
V'yeda. Okay.
He knew what his youngest son had done to him. Okay. Of course, it means that he understood, but it probably uses that phrase because it wants to reinforce that this whole paragraph is about knowing. Knowing in a biblical sense of chapter 4, verse 1 of Genesis, where it says, V'adam yada et chava ishto, that man knew his wife, and a son was born to them. And we're going to flesh this out as the minutes go by. Okay, what I want to do now is go back over the verses we just read and point out a number of key phrases, and sometimes we'll have to move to the Hebrew because I think that there's a lot of words being used here subtly to hint in different directions. So what I did on the sheet that I gave out to you, I listed key Hebrew words and phrases in the text. We have about 8 of them. Of course. So, the first word I wrote here, we should go to verse 20 and point out the word plant. It says, Noah, the tiller of the soil, was the first to plant the vineyard. So Noah is the first to plant the vineyard after the flood, right? But tell me, who planted before the flood? God. Where did God plant? Eden, right? So I am going to make the suggestion that we have here a subtle literary hint that's telling us when you read this story, read it in light of the Garden of Eden story. This is a second Garden of Eden. God planted a garden. And now Noah plants a garden. And why should we follow this direction of thought? Because think for a second. Think for a second. The Garden of Eden story appears right after God creates the world.
And this is a new beginning.
And this is, Jan just said it, this is a new creation of the world. The world was destroyed. Noah is a new Adam. His wife is a new Eve. They've come out of the ark. There's a new world here. They are repopulating the world. This is a second creation story. And we're going to read this story in light of chapter 2 and chapter 3 of Genesis, where there's also a creation story and then a garden story. And here again, a creation and then a garden story.
Do we have an idea of how much time there was between the first garden and the second garden?
We do and we don't.
If
we read it literally, we can simply count up the amount of years. It says each person how old they were when their children were born and then they died. Each person says how many years they lived. And if you count it up, it comes to, I don't know, about 1,000 years. I'm not sure. It comes to about 1,000 years. I'm not sure that we have to take that literally. That's a different story. Okay, so this planting, again, it starts us thinking. This planting plants seeds in our mind of connections here. Okay, now verse 21. Verse 21. says, he drank of the wine and became drunk, and he uncovered himself within his tent. Well, the Hebrew word here, as I put it on my sheet, is vayitgal. Vitgal. You can see the Hebrew again on the sheet that I prepared for you. The root is gimel lamid hey, gala, to reveal, to find, to discover. It's not a negative, it's not uncovering, it means to reveal. And we'll have to ask ourselves, as we continue our study today, if that word is meaningful. You know what? Well, Mimi already said it 15 minutes ago. Mimi pointed out that there's a phrase in the book of Leviticus of uncovering nakedness. It's the same word. It's called gilui. Yitgal gilui, it's the same root. Gilui arayot, uncovering nakedness, and it means sexual intimacy. We have to wonder here if this uncovering himself has anything to do with sexual intimacy, and we'll have to keep thinking about that and go back to it next class. We said next class we're continuing the same theme. Now comes something really... Oh, yes?
The correlation with the Garden of Eden, they had to cover themselves.
Oh, that's very good! That's fantastic!
Well, here they had to cover
right?
Themselves.
In the Garden of Eden, they were... uncovered, and they covered themselves. Another few minutes, we'll ask the question, why did they cover themselves?
When they sinned.
We'll have to think about that. So just wait 5 minutes, and we'll go back to that theme that's really important. That's really good.
You read the end of the book.
Before we get to that, verse 21, the last two words of verse 21 are his tent. Here, without the Hebrew, we're lost. His tent. So I put on my sheet what the Hebrew says. Does anyone besides Jan have the JPS Hebrew? You do. It could be confusing what they have there. I'll explain it. But what the Hebrew in the Torah says is what I have on the sheet here. Aleph, Hey, Lamed, Hey. Let's go over that word. Aleph, Hey, Lamed, Hey. First of all, the first three letters, Aleph, Hey, Lamed, Ohel, which means tent. No two ways about it. That's simple. And then you have the Hey at the end of the word, which means the following. Well, I'll ask you, what does it usually mean, the Hey at the end of a noun? I'll give you an example. Sefer. What does Sefer mean? Book. Sifra.
Many
books. No?
Reader.
No? Okay, I'll tell you. Yes. Let's do it like this. Right. Sefer Shelah. Shel is of. Shelah is of her. Sefer Shelah, book of her. Sifra is a shortened form of saying book of her. Sifra. Beita. Bait Shelah. Her house. Beita, her house. Ohel, Ohel Shelah, her Ohel. Ohelah, her Ohel, her tent. The way this word is written in the Hebrew, Aleph Hey Lamed tent, plus Hey at the end, would mean it should be pronounced Ohelah, and it should mean her tent. Except for the fact... Except for the fact that in the Torah, the book of the Torah, the Torah that's in the Ark, the Torah passed down for thousands of years, there's no vowels. Right. There's no vowels. Yeah. It's written, Aleph Hey Lamed Hey, Ohel, Ohelah, which should be her tent. But, despite the fact that in the written Torah, it says Ohel with a hey at the end. The tradition of how to pronounce it is different than the way it's written. We pronounce it not the way it's written. It's written as Ohelah. But we pronounce it as Ohelo. The tradition is pronounce this word different than it's written. And that's why I wrote a dot after the lamed, as if it's a dot of an O sound, to say Ohelah. What we have here again is a discrepancy between the tradition of how it's written and the tradition of how it's pronounced. Both of these traditions have been passed down for thousands of years, how you write it and how you pronounce it. It's only in the 10th century in the city of Tiberias that is a nomenclature, a system of recording how to pronounce it was codified. Vowels were only invented in the 10th century. Before then, we simply passed an oral tradition of how to pronounce it. And the traditional pronunciation was always Ohelo, meaning his tent, even though the written vowels are her tent. Okay, so now, with that information, we start thinking,
whose tent was he in?
Whose tent was he in? If he was in his own tent, then we understand he uncovered his own nakedness. And perhaps his son did something to him, perhaps he didn't do it, perhaps he only saw. But if it was in her tent, then something else perhaps was going on. And then what his son saw was quite a bit more embarrassing than if he was in his own tent. Let me add some information to that, by the way, just to make it more juicy. The rabbis have a tradition, it doesn't have any basis in the Torah as far as I know, but they have a tradition that during all the many, many, many months of their stay in the ark, sexual intimacy was forbidden. During destruction, there's not to be any procreation. When they left the ark, procreation, sexual intimacy was allowed. This is right after they left the ark. Perhaps it's the story of the first sexual intimacy, which is disturbed by Ham. Okay, these are just things to think about. And next week we'll see some commentators that try and flesh this out. Okay, we'll go on. He meaning the son. Why wasn't the tent door locked? Right. Yeah.
Or he had sex with someone and then drunkenly he went back to his tent. And he just laid there naked.
But if we were to work on this his tent, her tent,
yeah,
it would be easier to say the sexual intimacy is in the tent itself, not earlier, because if it's in a, he's in a her tent.
But where is the lady?
Oh, so if it's a her tent, I'm assuming it's his wife, because there's no other hers around, right, except for his daughter-in-laws.
Yeah, right.
Well,
if you want to go in that place, that's a whole new, whole other tent. Yes.
It's not like it hasn't happened before.
Yeah.
But I think that it was, I think that the sexual intimacy was in the tent because it says that he uncovered himself within his tent. So, I mean, I don't think it happened. I don't think it was that he was drunk and then after he was dead, went back to his tent.
Yeah, indeed, right? That's what I would say to Bruce also.
Okay.
How did he single out Kanaan? I mean, that child of Ham, he had other children. Why that one?
That's a fantastic question that we're leaving on the table for next week. Yeah, indeed. Okay, let's see some more here. Let's see some more here. Now look at verse 22. Verse 22, Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness. And I simply point out that the Hebrew is Vayar Ham Avi Canaan et Ervat Aviv. He saw his father's nakedness, and we will see that that reminds us, as we've said earlier, when Mimi mentioned it, reminds us of expressions in the book of Leviticus. The next little literary point here is, I assume, not one that you would have thought of. Verse 23 says that they put the garment, the towel, the blanket, the sheet on their shoulders. And the word for shoulders is Shechem. And I wonder if anyone recognizes that word from someplace else in the Torah.
Story of Dinah.
Say it again?
Story of Dinah.
You got it. Can you say it loudly?
The story of Dinah, it happens in Shechem.
The story of Dinah happened in Shechem. Not only did it happen in the town of Shechem, but it was done by someone whose name was Shechem. And what did he do? In one word.
It was rape.
Rape.
Supposedly rape.
I wonder if this story of Noah and his wife or of his sons, which is all about some type of sexual perversity, it happens to use the word Shechem, which just reminded Jan of a story, something in the Torah about rape. I wonder if there's a connection. And we'll have to leave that for next week also. But it just goes to show you that without the Hebrew, you're up a creek. There are all different types of literary allusions that might or might not be here that you can't see in the English. Now just let me say, That there's another word in Hebrew for back, gav. Why did it specifically use the word Shechem, perhaps again, in order to tie it to the story of Shechem, who raped? And then we'll just have to wonder, and I'm not going to answer this now, the rapist, whose name was Shechem, was a descendant of some of the people in the story, and the girl raped was a descendant of other people in the story. That's going to be important.
Just a far better question, the question of why single out Canaan among all of Hamza, the children. And I'm wondering, at what point were these various children of Noah's sons born? Was it possible that Ham had already fathered Canaan at the time that this takes place, but the others came afterwards?
Well, given that Ham is the youngest,
you would think the others would have come first. But
you'd think that the others already had children.
But was this perhaps Ham's first son and the others came later? Know that we have any indication.
Well, I'm looking now in chapter 10, verse 6.
It lists Canaan as his last.
As his last. Lord. And usually they're in order. Not always, but usually.
Okay.
So now,
so that theory doesn't work.
In verse 23, covered their father's nakedness, vayichasu et ervat avihem. We've talked enough about covering and uncovered nakedness. We'll go on and we'll get back to it later. Verse 23, they did not see their father's nakedness. Okay, we've also talked enough about seeing and not seeing. Verse 24, v'yeda, he knew, and we talked also about that earlier, right? He knew what had been done to him. Does that word tie us back to the Genesis story when Adam knew his wife? We'll have to think about that. One other point now in verse 25 to set the groundwork before we start thinking in larger terms. Verse 25 in our translation says, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves." The Hebrew says, "Evid avadim." It doesn't say the lowest of slaves, it says slave of slaves. Now perhaps slave of slaves means the lowest of slaves, but perhaps it also means literally a slave of a slave. And of course, if you're cursing your son's son by saying he's a slave of slaves, you are therefore also cursing the son. So that might be something to think about, which we'll get to next week. Yes?
Cursed Ham because Ham saw whatever he saw. And the other brothers, they put the thing on the back and they walked backwards, so they never saw him naked.
Right.
So they were blessed.
Right.
He never saw him. And
Right. That's 100% true. Did everyone hear that?
Yeah.
Right. That the two son, one son here is the symbol of unchastity. He sees. The other two sons prevent themselves from seeing. And they are blessed because they are representatives here of chastity, of modesty. And again, we'll have to see next week how, or even at the end of this class, how these things play themselves out in other stories. Okay, so now let's think of all the connections. We're going to another part of our class now. Let's think of all the connections that we started developing between this story and the creation story in chapter 2 and 3 of Genesis. Let's turn to 2 and 3 of Genesis. So first of all, in chapter 2, and I'm just following the sheets that I gave out to you, right? Following the sheets I gave out to you. In chapter 2 of Genesis, it says in verse 8 that the Lord God planted a garden in Eden. We already pointed out that this is just like the planting that Noah planted in the second creation of the world, the creation of the world after the flood. And now I want to look at verse 17. Verse 17 of chapter 2 says, "But as for the tree of knowledge of good and bad, you must not eat of it, for as soon as you eat of it, you shall die." We never talked about in this class when we began the book of Genesis what this tree actually represents. And we can't do it full justice now, but I do want to bring up one very, very possible possibility. The tree of knowledge of good and evil. Let's think. Before they ate of this tree, it says in verse 25 that they were both naked and weren't ashamed, right? It says in verse 25. Look at verse 25. Mm-hmm. Before they ate of it, they were naked and not ashamed. And then it says in chapter 3, verse 7, that after they ate of it, what happened? Look at 3:7.
They covered themselves.
Right. They covered themselves. The eyes of both of them were naked. I'm sorry, were opened. Mm-hmm. And they perceived that they were naked. They sewed together fig leaves and made themselves loincloths. So what is the result of eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil? Sexual awareness. They weren't aware of being naked. They weren't ashamed. It didn't bother them. There was no sexual drive. It was meaningless that they were uncovered. They eat of the tree, and now they have a certain knowledge. Knowledge of nakedness, which means a certain sexual awareness, a certain sexual arousal, which brings shame. So it would turn out, therefore, that perhaps, the tree of knowledge of good and evil is a tree of knowledge in the sense of carnal knowledge. Like we said, it says in chapter 4 that man knew his wife. This is a tree of knowing in the sense of carnal knowledge. Then why does it say knowledge of good and evil? Could good and evil be a euphemism for sexuality? See, please, the second book of Shmuel.
So again, appropriate and inappropriate.
Appropriate and inappropriate. So in that sense, I want to see, as I wrote here on the sheet, see the second book of Shmuel, chapter 19, verse 32.
Rabbi, why? This seems to be blaming. When you read from verse 6 on, it seems to be blaming the woman.
Yeah? The second book of Shmuel, chapter 19.
Oh, no. No, I'm still back in Genesis.
Yes, so I didn't understand what you were saying.
She took of it and it was fruit and ate.
Yeah.
It seems to be that they're only blaming the woman for being aroused, understanding what sex was.
Well, it says that she's blamed for eating of the apple.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Well, let me read this again.
I don't want to go into all the details of that story, because that's not our subject.
Okay.
But look at 2 Shmuel, chapter 19, verse 32, which is on page 502. You ready? 2 Shmuel, chapter 19, verse 32. Barzillai, the Giladi, had come down from Roglim. Roglim is a city right near, it's a town right near Jerusalem, and passed on to the Jordan with the king to see him off at the Jordan. At this point, King David is fleeing for his life because he's being pursued by his son who wants to kill him. His son has usurped the throne, and David is fleeing across the Jordan. Barzillai was very old, 80 years of age, and he'd provided the king with food during his stay at Machanaim, for he was a very wealthy man. The king said to me, "Cross over with me, and I will provide for you in Jerusalem at my side." In other words, come with me as I'm fleeing now over the Jordan, and when I eventually get the kingship back, and I come back to Jerusalem, I'll pay you back for being my faithful follower. But Barzillai said to the king, "How many years are left to me that I should go up with your majesty to Jerusalem? I'm an old man. I won't make it until you eventually get your throne back. I am now 80 years old. Can I tell the difference between good and bad?" Hebrew says, "Can I know?" Can you read it again? Read it. What does it say?
I just lost my place.
Right. Do I know good from bad? That's what he says. We'll go back to that in a second. We'll read on. Can your servant taste what he eats and drinks? Can I still listen to the singing of men and women? Why then should your servant continue to be a burden to my lord the king? Okay, so what is he saying? He's saying, I'm an old man. I have no sense of taste left. I can't enjoy life. I can't hear. I can't appreciate the singing of men singing and women singing. So then what does he mean when he says, do I know the difference between good and bad? What could that mean?
I'm not even up to sex anymore.
That's what it means. That's what it means. He's just telling the king, I'm an old man. I don't enjoy life anymore, so it's not worth me coming with you. Apparently, knowing good and bad is a euphemism for sexual ability. That's all it is. Plug that back into the Garden of Eden story. Plug it back into the story. The tree of knowledge and good and bad is one thing. Perhaps it's more, but for our purposes now, it's at least one thing. It's the tree that provides knowledge of sexuality. Sexual awareness. The awareness of sexuality. And we saw, like we said, before they ate of the tree, they're naked, they see each other's nakedness, but they don't see. It doesn't mean anything. After they eat of the tree, they have to cover themselves up. So we now learn something very interesting. We said at the beginning that God plants a garden after creation, and then after the second creation, Noah plants a garden. And now we see that what goes on in these two gardens is actually the same thing. Noah's garden, what goes on is sex, in some sense, in some way. We didn't figure it out yet, but it's about seeing nakedness, uncovered, not covered. And now it turns out the Garden of Eden was about the same thing. In some sense, in some way, was about it was about sexuality. It was about a sin of eating of the fruit that brought about sexuality. So now it seems that both of these gardens have the same thing going on in them. They have certain type of sin related to sexuality. More than that, I don't know yet. But there's a clear, clear parallel. Okay, let's see a few more verses. Let's see now verse 3, chapter 10. Yeah, I'm sorry. We're going back to the beginning of Genesis. Beginning of Genesis.
Chapter
3,
verse 10.
Verse 10. And what it says in chapter 3, verse 10, is after they ate of the fruit, and they became aware of sexuality, they became embarrassed and made for themselves clothing. So God finds out, and he says, you know, where are you? And the man says in verse 10, he replied, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked. I was afraid because I was naked. Why is he afraid because he's naked? Well, if you look in the Hebrew, which I brought for you on my sheet, you see it says, V'ira ki erom anuchi, which means, I was afraid. Except that word for afraid
could be,
it's the same consonants as the word,
the verb to see.
I saw that I was naked. I saw that I was naked.
Sort of a pun, almost a pun, because of the similarities between the two words.
Right, it's both afraid and sore at the same time. And we just say to ourselves, wow, he sees his own nakedness, which reminds us again of Noah's garden, which is all about, in Noah's garden, it's all about seeing nakedness. And we just wonder again if the Torah is purposely making these connections between the first garden and the second garden. Let's see something else now. Another connection. Chapter 3, verse 12. This might be a little bit more tenuous. Chapter 3, verse 12. God says to the man, why did you eat of this fruit? And the man said, the woman you put at my side, she gave me of the tree and I ate. Noah passes the buck. He shirks responsibility. Right? He says, it's her fault, it's not my fault. Well, the truth is, that happened also in our garden in the Noah story. Where was there a shirking of responsibility there?
Something
more?
Like when he cursed the son instead of, I mean, the grand, the son of Ham,
But the two other brothers didn't stop whatever happened.
There's something else. I purposely said again.
Ask the question again.
Where is there a shirking, a personal shirking of responsibility in chapter 9? Noah got drunk. Yeah. He uncovered himself. When he woke up in the morning, the first thing he did is blame someone else. I understand his son might have done something or might have seen something, but who's first responsible? Noah himself. That's conveniently forgotten. So I'm just saying this to point out another parallel between chapters 2 and 3 and chapter 9, which is the shirking of responsibility by the man that's responsible for what happened. But that's not all. That's not the only. It's not just 3 and not 4. There's another point of contact between the two stories, which is chapter 3, verse 17. Chapter 3, verse 17. What God, yes?
But the man said unto number 12, the woman you put at my side.
Hey, he's blaming someone else, blaming God and blaming the woman.
Always our fault.
So, when the woman sinned, and when the man sinned, and when the snake sinned, in chapter 2 and chapter 3, what God does in 17, he says, to Adam, he said, because you did as your wife said, and ate of the tree of that which I commanded, you shall not eat of it, cursed be the ground. Cursed. And lo and behold, chapter 9 has a curse in it. And just another literary parallel. Both of these stories of sexual perversion, in some sense, sexual sin, these stories of the shirking responsibility, they end up with a curse. That's all. And of course, we already talked about how the whole thing ends. Just one more point. In chapter 4, verse 1, now the man knew his wife Eve. The story of the attaining of sexual awareness ends with sexual awareness, ends with sexual intimacy. And we just wonder if that's another connection to chapter 9, in which Noah wakes up and he knows what happened to him. The same word, to know. One other thing I just want to point out that just might be on your mind, it's not a matter of connection between the two stories, it's the following. If we're claiming that there was no sexual intimacy before the sin, because there was no sexual awareness, then you might ask me, well, how is there going to be reproduction?
That was my question, because I'm sitting...
Ah, okay, thank you for asking.
You shall be fruitful and multiply, and there's a contradiction there.
Okay, so I'll first say that I am implicitly relying on what I said in earlier classes, that I view chapter 1 and chapter 2 of Genesis as two different stories. So the fact that it says in chapter 1, be fruitful and multiply, doesn't bother me. But it does bother me in chapter 2, no fruit will multiply, but how is the world going to continue if there's no sex? The answer might be the following. Remember that they're told, don't eat of the tree, lest you eat of it and die. But they didn't die after they ate of it. So what happened? What might be is that eat of it and die means eat of it and become subject to death, become mortal. In other words, before the sin, they were meant to be immortal. After the sin, they become mortal. That's what it means, they will die. They began dying. What does it have to do with reproduction and sex? Perhaps chapter 2 and chapter 3 have a vision of a Garden of Eden populated by one man and one woman forever. No children, no reproduction, no sex, they just live forever. As a result of the sin, they become sexual creatures, therefore reproducing, and if they're going to reproduce, they no longer can be immortal. It's either one of the, take your pick, either you're immortal, without children, without sex, or you're mortal, with sexuality and children. And the sin transferred the world from one type to another, from the immortal without children to the mortal with children. That's a side point that we could have done when we studied chapter 2 and chapter 3. We're now in chapter 9, so it's not important.
I have 2 points. One, and it's just my interpretation of one of the reasons why it became a sin and we covered ourselves is to differentiate ourselves from the animals. You know, Adam and Eve would see how the animals would have sex whenever they wanted to, and that just made, you know, man different from the animals. And then my other point is, God put the curse on Adam. What gives Noah the authority to put a curse and make it stick? I mean, it's one thing when God does it. It's another thing when a man does it.
That's a very good question, and I also don't have an answer. And I don't think we're going to see an answer. In other words, it's a whole question, by the way, in the whole Torah. What does it mean to curse? Does the Torah believe in the efficacy of a curse? Does a curse work?
Right.
I have nothing to say.
Okay.
It's a good question.
Okay.
So now that we've seen that these two creation stories are extremely parallel, I want to point out a difference between them. Let's see if I have this on the sheet here. First, the back of the sheet, I just want to point out that the Talmud actually asks us to look for all the connections we just found between chapters 2 and 3 and chapter 9. The Babylon and Talmud Tractatus in a Dream, tied to 7a and 7db, says, "And Noah began to be a husbandman," which is simply an ancient translation for a man of the earth, which our translation says, he began to be a
tiller of the soil.
And he planted a vineyard.
He began to be a what?
Tiller of the soil.
Oh, a tiller.
Yeah. Okay. In the 1917 translation, a tiller of the soil is a husbandman.
Husbandry.
Husbandry. Yes. Animal husbandry. Soil husbandry. What does the Talmud say about that? The Talmud says, Rav Kista said in Rav Ukba's name, and others state, Mar Ukba said in Rav Zakai's name. There's a question of who said what. But what did they say? The Holy One, blessed be He, said unto Noah, Noah, shouldn't thou not have taken a warning from Adam, whose transgression was caused by wine? That's the end of the statement. And then the Talmud has another layer that says, disagrees with the view that the forbidden tree from which Adam ate was a vine. All I want from reading this is to show that the Talmud points out to us, when you read the story of Noah's sin, connect it to the story of Adam's sin. That's all. The Talmud doesn't point out the five different literary connections we just found. But the Talmud, I think, is telling us, look for those connections. We should read one story in light of the other. So if we should read one story in light of the other, then the question is going to be, what do we learn from this? So, I'm just going to get my notes for a second. Yes. There is a major difference between the stories. And I think this will bring us to highlighting the point of our story of Noah's vineyard and Noah's sin. In the Garden of Eden story of sexual sin, everyone sins. Adam sins, Eve sins, there's no one that doesn't sin. They're the only people on earth. It's a story of downfall. And there's no silver lining. They all sin. In our story, chapter 9, Noah sins and Ham sins, but there are people who don't sin. There's a silver lining. Not only do Shem and Yafet not sin, they actually redeem the sin. Perhaps I should say that differently. They actually counter the sin by working against it. Their younger brother sinned in something called seeing his father's nakedness, whatever that means, we'll get to it. We've talked of some possibilities. But they fight against it. So that their father's nakedness will not be seen, they don't look. They walk backwards. Not only that, they cover their father. In other words, what I'm trying to say is, it's not just that history repeats itself, and there's another sexual sin that leads us to sexual depravity, whatever it might be, but rather there's a development here of two strands. Those who continue the sexual sin of Adam and Eve, and that's Ham, and perhaps Noah himself, by uncovering himself, but there's a new direction here. There's hope for the future. They're representatives of chastity. And again, exactly what happened we don't know yet, but they're representative chastity, which are Shem and Yafet. And this is going to be the beginning, as we're about to see in the last few minutes of our class, of a conflict throughout the Torah, throughout history, as depicted in the Torah, of two different directions. One direction of Ham and his descendants, representing sexual depravity, you say?
Mm-hmm.
And another direction, the descendants of Shem and Yafet, representing sexual chastity. And that brings us to Dina.
Just out of curiosity, does Noah have any more descendants after this, like 9 months later or anything?
No, and that's actually going to be the subject of a midrash we'll see next week. Perhaps what his son did to him is something that prevents him from having another son.
Okay.
And I won't say what I mean. That what did his son do when he saw? We said perhaps he did something. Perhaps he did something that prevented Noah from having another son. And that's in a midrash we'll see next week.
Also, the other two sons that were not cursed, they lost no respect for their father. By not seeing.
So
I think that's where God blessed them, because they retained their...
Right, they refused to see. They tried to protect their father. Mm-hmm. Leslie?
My only problem with all of this is if somebody didn't sin, we wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
You know, there'd be no book, there'd be no Torah, there'd be no history.
So I'll say to that two things. The first thing I know what I'm going to say, the second thing I don't know what I'm going to say, I have to think of it. But the first thing I'm going to say is, and it's only my personal opinion, I don't take some of this literally. And remember, I personally read chapter 1 and chapter 2 and 3 of Genesis as two different stories. In other words, I would say we'd still be here had it not been for the sin in chapter 2 and 3 because of chapter 1,
right,
which talks about reproduction as part of the purpose of creation. It's only in chapter 2 and 3 that has a different view of things. But it could be, according to chapter 2 and 3, that we wouldn't be here had it not been for the sin. But again, we don't take it literally necessarily. Anyway, I want to finish up with the following. This will take. Oh wait, we're already over time. We just have to finish this. So we said as follows. In the chapter 9, two different directions begin to develop: the sexual sinners and those who are chaste. Now, let's follow those lines of descendants and see where they lead us. And that this will end with. So we're going to look, as my sheet says, to look at Genesis chapter 10, verse 6, and then verses 15 to 20. So we look at Genesis chapter 10, verse 6, and it says, the descendants of Ham, Cush which is Ethiopia, Mitzrayim, which is Egypt, Put, which I think is Libya, I'm not sure, and Canaan. Okay, then we go to verse 15, and we read, Canaan begat Sidon. Sidon is Tripoli today. And that is, it's those who live in the area of Lebanon. His firstborn, and Het, Het, they're the Hittites that live in Canaan, the land of Canaan, land of Israel, and the Jebusites also live. Jebusites were the people that lived in the city of Jerusalem before the Jews came to the land. The Amorites, of course, those also live in the land of Canaan. The Girgashites, same thing. The Hivites, the same thing. And then a few others that we're not going to talk about. Then it says, verse 19, the original Canaanite territory extended from Sidon, that's in the north, that's Lebanon, until Grar. Grar is what we call today Aza, the area of Ashkelon and Aza, near Gaza, as far as Stone. And then it goes to, that's from north to south, and now from east to west. The west is, of course, the Mediterranean. The east, as far as Sodom and Gomorrah, which is the Dead Sea. Admat Zeboim, etc. So what are we being told here? That who inherited what we today call the land of Israel? It was inherited by the son of Ham, who was cursed by Canaan, by Canaan, and his descendants.
It was a justification for taking over the land.
Exactly.
Didn't hear what she said.
It sort of forms a justification for dispossessing those people from the land and taking it over. Because when they leave Egypt, they're going to run all those folks out.
And those people who inhabit the land of Canaan are implicitly accused here of being in descendants spiritually and morally of Canaan. You'll see where I'm going in another 1 second now. Who are the sons, verse 21, sons were also born to Shem. We wrote the whole verse, the point, the son of 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 Shem was Abraham. We Jews are of Shem, that's why we're called Semites. Semite means Shemite, from Shem. And the point is, as Jan said it, the Shemites, or the Israelites, are going to take the land of Israel from the Canaanites, and the issue that's going to be the battle between them is, you guessed it, sexual morality. And that, we're in the class with that. Let's just see the verses. The first verse we're going to see is Genesis chapter 34, when the Shemites go head to head with the sons of Canaan over the rape of Dinah. Look in chapter 34. Chapter 34, verse 1. Now Dinah, the daughter whom Leah had born to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land, seeing. The Aaron says visit, it says see. Shechem reminds us of something. Son of Hamor, the Hivite. The Hivite, we just learned, are sons of the Canaan. Chief of the country saw her, took her, and lay with her by force. In other words, those who represent sexual impropriety are still at it. That's the point of the story. It's the sons of Shem, the good guys, against the sons of Ham and Canaan, the bad guys. The first connection between them is rape. And then, and this is what we're ending with now, I really promise we're going to end with Vayikra chapter 18. And this will lead us into next week's class. Vayikra chapter 18, Leviticus chapter 18. Leviticus chapter 18, very beginning of the chapter. Page 183. The Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the Israelite people and say to them, I, the Lord, am your God. You shall not copy the practices of the land of Egypt where you dwell. Egypt was also a son of Canaan, we just learned. Or of the land of Canaan to which I am taking you. Nor shall you follow their laws. So the Jewish people, the sons of Shem, being told, don't be like the Egyptians, don't be like the Canaanites, and don't be like them in what matter? We're going to read now the whole chapter in a second. Verse 6, none of you shall come near any of his own flesh to uncover it nakedness. Your father's nakedness, that is the nakedness of your mother, you shall not uncover. She is your mother. You shall not uncover his nakedness. Do not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife, the nakedness of his brother, etc., etc., etc. The whole chapter is about sexual sin. The whole chapter. In other words, when it says, don't be like the Canaanites, what does it mean? It means don't be like you read in chapter 9 of Genesis. Don't be like was done there. Rather be like Shem, who you're descended from, who covered nakedness. And I just want to point out that among the many sins listed here, we have to look at verse 22. Do not lie with a male as one lies with a woman.
We wonder if that's what...
If that goes back to chapter 9, which was what we'll talk about next week. Okay.